A month after the report was released, nearly two-thirds of Americans had now heard of the Marshall Plan, up from just under half 2 months prior. At least as important, 56% had a favorable impression, and only 17% an unfavorable one. The poll numbers gave skeptical congressmen leeway to consider legislation without having to posture against the president. Without the Harriman and Herter committee's bipartisan support for the Marshall Plan, the program couldn't have gotten congressional approval, Hoffman reflected years later, but it was far from sufficient. Even the open-minded still had reservations. I raised the question, Representative Lawrence Smith said before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs on November 14th, and it is a sincere one. Can we expect from these nations any more in the future than we have gotten in the past so long as we give and give? Overcoming such doubts took more than congressional fact-finding tours and committee reports. It required shaping voter opinion. Given how little hard public knowledge there was of the Marshall Plan, this required a massive, carefully orchestrated public relations campaign. A Marshall Plan to sell the Marshall Plan. Impetus for the most important such effort came from wartime Secretary of War Henry Stimson, a Republican, in the form of an article in the October issue of Foreign Affairs. Having won the war at enormous cost, Stimson argued, the United States could not now afford to lose the peace. Only 2 years ago, we triumphantly ended the greatest war in history, Stimson wrote. Most of us then looked forward eagerly to the relative relaxation of peace. Reluctantly, we have now come to understand that victory and peace are not synonymous. Close on the heels of victory has loomed a new world crisis. That crisis was being created by the tide of Soviet expansion, which, in the absence of firm and immediate American action to counter it, would roll into the empty places left by the war. Those most immediately threatened are the nations by whose citizens our land was settled and in whose tradition our civilization is rooted. The United States had both a moral and selfish interest in confronting this threat. The reconstruction of Western Europe, he wrote, is a task from which Americans can decide to stand apart only if they wish to desert every principle by which they claim to live. A prompt and large-scale program was required. The penalty of delay was to increase the size of the job and multiply difficulties. And whereas he did not expect the Russians to make war, the United States needed to prepare for one. Our military strength must be maintained as a standing discouragement to aggression. In broad strokes, much as Marshall had used in June at Harvard, Stimson laid out the case for a European recovery program, while also adumbrating what would the following year become more explicit calls for a Western military alliance to protect America's investment in Europe's recovery and political stabilization. The article became a rallying cry for the most important of the many private initiatives set up to advocate for passage of a massive European assistance program, the Committee for the Marshall Plan to Aid European Recovery, often called the Marshall Plan Committee. Stimson became its national chairman. Stimson's successor as Secretary of War, Robert Patterson, became chairman of the Executive Committee. In addition to former top government officials, most importantly Acheson and Clayton, some 300 notables from business, labor, agriculture, religion, and academia became active members. Acheson in particular was ubiquitous, appearing on radio, at luncheon talks, and at evening functions around the country. The group formed a lobbying organization, created a speakers bureau, and employed a news agency to spread their message. It shaped the details of the aid bill legislation, prepared material for witnesses at congressional hearings, and drew critical public attention to legislative restrictions and amendments it deemed objectionable. Many other private groups worked in support of the initiative, such as the nonprofit National Planning Association and Committee for Economic Development, both of which focused on how the Marshall Plan should be administered. Think tanks such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Brookings Institution produced papers and convened meetings. Frequently, there were fewer than 6 degrees of separation among the leaders of these initiatives. Of the 19 luminaries on the Executive Committee of the Marshall Plan Committee, 8 were CFR members. Alan Dulles, brother of John Foster Dulles, was president of CFR. Acheson, who joined CFR in December 1947, was also on the Brookings Board of Directors. Though some were Democrats and some Republicans, they were like-minded internationalists who associated with internationalist-minded institutions. Myriad business, labor, agriculture, veteran, and religious organizations weighed in the main, highly supportive. Industry groups representing specific sectors, such as tobacco growers and flower dealers, were naturally enthusiastic at the prospect of having their commodities distributed abroad with government dollars. But the communist argument that the Marshall Plan was about forcing American exports on Europe to forestall a domestic depression found little support in the behavior of industry groups. The leadership of the National Foreign Trade Council, NFTC, the Committee for Economic Development, CED, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the National Association of Manufacturers, NAM, all backed the administration's aims of boosting intra-European trade, stabilizing finances, and closing the dollar gap, Western Europe's balance of payments deficits with the dollar area, that the new IMF was unable to address. Union leaders were also enthusiastic. "The ultimate price of a refusal to put the Marshall Plan into effect is war," declared AFL Secretary George Meany, "a war in which America would be practically alone." The AFL and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO, which also supported the plan, counted over 10 million American workers as members. Iowa farmers organized their own mission to Europe to find out what kind of food Europe needs, the cost to ship it over, and how we can get England in a position whereby she can trade with us. The annual convention of the 3.2 million member American Legion voted unanimously to endorse the plan, as it did a second resolution calling for the Communist Party to be outlawed. Speaking on behalf of the World Assembly of the World Council of Churches, the Reverend Dr. Stuart Herman, Jr., declared the Marshall Plan to be "nearer to being Christian than anything offered to Europe by a single government or by a group of governments for more than a generation." The Right Reverend Charles Gilbert, Episcopal Bishop of the New York Diocese, called it "a plan that would bring new life and hope to the vast multitudes of God's despairing children." It should, he said, have the support of Christians everywhere. The Truman Organization organized grassroots campaigns to build awareness of the program and to explain to Americans how they could help. "The way Mother can have an effective hand in accomplishing this important part of the United States foreign policy," Agriculture Undersecretary Norris Dodd told the Women's National Democratic Club, "is to buy closely, figure out ways to make tasteful meals from the less choice but nonetheless nutritious foods, and put leftovers into tempting dishes instead of into the garbage can." Marshall, speaking at the National Garden Conference, called on Americans to plant 20 million Freedom Gardens to supplement the aid program. "Never in history," he said, "had it been more important to raise as much food as possible. And I don't speak from a desk in the State Department," he added. "I ordered my seeds and settings 10 days ago." Spontaneous public initiatives spread up to supplement the Marshall Plan. Responding to a suggestion from syndicated columnist Drew Pearson for a friendship train to travel the country collecting goods and food for Europe, restaurants, schools, and private societies such as the Kiwanis Club donated tons worth. Greeted by banners and parades as it passed through cities and towns, its 214 boxcars painted with slogans such as "Vive la France" and "Viva l'Italia," the train arrived in New York on November 18th. Following more fanfare, the supplies were then shipped to Europe on donated commercial liner space. The first shipments arrived 1 month later on December 17th in Le Havre, France, at docks decorated in stars and stripes and the tricolore. Dock workers donating their time unloaded them 1 week after they had been on strike against American imperialism. As the belief took hold among the American people that the epic European aid initiative would soon become reality, grand new applications of its thinking began to emerge. In December, a group of economists from the American South, in collaboration with experts from various government departments, prepared a report for the House Agriculture Committee, arguing that the South needed its own Marshall Plan to address endemic underdevelopment, rooted in a rutted agrarian economic system. It suggested that the staggering sum of approximately $13.4 billion, $145 billion in today's money, is required for technological investment in the South during the next 20 years, much of which would need to be federally funded. In February 1948, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals even demanded a Marshall Plan for Europe's pets and strays. No problem of deprivation and suffering, it seemed, was too big or too small for a Marshall Plan. If the spirit of Yalta died in Paris in July 1947, it looked set to be buried in London in November. The four-power meeting had been on the calendar since April, but differences over Germany had hardened so much and were of such consequence that there seemed little left for the two sides to do but posture. Though the administration's position was not to admit having established a political structure for Western Germany, Ambassador Robert Murphy argued in October that they had to be ready to move forward with one after the conference broke down, as he expected it to do. The United States would inevitably be accused of splitting Germany, but that could not stand in the way. Marshall told the cabinet on November 6th that the Soviets would use various ruses to try to get us out of Western Germany under arrangements which would leave that country defenseless against communist penetration, but that the United States had to ensure the opposite, that Germany become better integrated into Western Europe. Over in Moscow, Molotov prepped for the conference with a memorandum from Andrei Smirnov, head of the Foreign Ministry's most important European department. Smirnov chronicled shifts in the Western stance on Germany over the past 18 months. Molotov, blue pencil in hand, underlined passages suggesting Allied guilt. The Western position had fundamentally changed. In 1946, they wanted a settlement quickly built on the basis of the Potsdam decisions. By the beginning of 1947, however, they were seeking a substitute for the peace settlement, one that relieved the German government of the responsibility of carrying out the conditions. Then, after the Moscow Council of Foreign Ministers conference in March, there was further deviation from the Potsdam decisions, efforts aimed at a separate resolution of the German problem without the Soviet Union. The American position now stood in complete opposition to that which Burns defended in 1946. Molotov thickly underlined complete opposition, adding in the lower margin, "Is that so?" And later, "Burns? What did he say?" On May 29, 1947, the memo continued, "The Anglo-American agreement on the creation of an economic council was concluded, closing out the formulation of West Germany into a separate political unit." And on July 11th, the U.S. government sent General Clay a new directive, at odds with the Potsdam decisions, and focused mainly on the attraction of West Germany to the implementation of the Marshall Plan. Then, from August 22nd to 27th, negotiations between the representatives of the U.S., U.K., and France regarding the industrial production level for the Anglo-American zone of Germany took place in London. Also addressed was the management of the Ruhr mines and control over them. As a result of these negotiations, the British and the Americans have created a new plan for the zone's level of industrial production, overturning decisions made by the Allied Control Council in March 1946. Thus armed with the history of Allied betrayal since 1946, Molotov warily agreed to receive the French ambassador, Georges Coutrou, for a discussion of German matters on November 5th. Coutrou, Molotov reported to Stalin, said he wanted to try to move the Soviet and French position closer together. In particular, he wished to explore what it might take for Moscow to come nearer to the French view on international administration of the Ruhr. The Frenchman stressed that he was acting on his own initiative without any sort of orders from his government. Clay would have seen Coutrou's behavior as predictable Gallic duplicity. Molotov certainly did, but from the opposing lens. "The meeting with Coutrou," he told Stalin, "demonstrated that the Americans and the English are now trying to use the French to feel out our position on the German question." Molotov distrusted the British even more deeply than he did the French. When in London to negotiate an Anglo-Soviet treaty in May 1942, he surrounded himself with bodyguards and slept with a revolver by his bed. Now back in London, on November 25, 1947, Molotov entered the gilded salon of Lancaster House in a cherry mood. The fifth meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers opened precisely where the Moscow gathering had left off, in acrimony over Germany. Abandoning his usual poker face for an air of impatience, Molotov reprised Moscow's familiar demands for $10 billion in reparations. Marshall, however, had even less room for maneuver than in March. With Congress watching over his shoulder, any concession would threaten prospects for aid legislation. With the discussion thus deadlocked from the start, Bevin felt he had nothing to lose in a frank personal appeal. He invited Molotov to his flat on December 2nd. "When our government was trying to stamp out your revolution," Bevin asked him, "who was it that stopped it?" "It was I," he said emphatically. "I called out the transport workers and they refused to load the ships. Now again I'm speaking as a friend. You are playing with fire, Mr. Molotov. If war comes between you and America in the West, then we shall be on America's side. That would be the end of Russia and of your revolution. So please stop sticking out your neck in this way and tell me what you are after."
"I want to unify Germany," replied his stony-faced guest.
"Why do you want that?" Bevin retorted. "A unified Germany might pretend to go communist, but in their hearts they would be longing for the day when they could revenge their defeat at Stalingrad. You know that as well as I do." Molotov was immovable. As French diplomat René Massilli characterized it, "it was only by espousing German unity that the Soviet Union obtains the means of extending its influence throughout Germany." Actions by both sides on the ground, however, made unity impossible. While invoking Potsdam to demand their rights in Western Germany, the Soviets fell back on its exceptions relating to local variations in each occupied zone to assert exclusive powers in the East. Operating through the KPD Communist Party, they had radically transformed their zone, seizing landholdings and nationalizing firms. Meanwhile, the British and Americans acknowledged privately that preparations for implementing the Marshall Plan had deepened the economic split in Germany. Unification was unacceptable, as it would have allowed the Soviets to siphon out Marshall Plan assistance through reparations claims. Meeting with Marshall on December 6th, Bevin suggested they lay out for Molotov requirements for Germany's political organization in such a way as to provoke him into revealing, for the record, that the Soviet objection was a communist-controlled Germany. Then the rupture would be his doing. Marshall, however, waved him off. "Yes, it would be popular with the American people just to break off and tell the Russians to go to the devil, but it was unwise. It was better to assure Molotov that we were not permanently breaking with them, that cooperation was possible if differences on matters of real substance could be resolved down the road." Marshall was proposing to behave as Stalin had in April, cloaking unwillingness to collaborate further in hollow expressions of hope. Yet after several further days of fruitless conferencing, Marshall could see no way of winding matters down amicably. He cabled Lovett with a message for the president: "It is plainly evident that Molotov is not only playing for time, but endeavoring to reach agreements which really would be an embarrassment to us in the next 4 to 6 months." Marshall requested permission to end the talks. "We are all with you," Truman responded. The tone of the meetings now hardened toward mutual contempt. On December 12th, Molotov charged that the aim of American aid was to enslave Germany and to make it a strategic base against the democratic states of Eastern Europe. Marshall's team had been waiting for such a tirade and began scribbling responses to pass on to him. He ignored them all, telling the Russian that his words were self-evidently not intended to be used as a basis for council discussion, but solely for propaganda purposes. That Molotov would offer them in such a context, he added, reflected on the dignity of the government of the Soviet Union. Molotov grimaced. Clay had never seen him so angry. Bevin piled on. "Molotov's insults," he said,
would be resented throughout the British Commonwealth. He should have ended his speech by thanking his colleagues for listening to the end. On December 15th, Marshall told Molotov he was done discussing German reparations. They had reached an impasse. The problem, as ever, was Soviet obstructionism. No, Molotov shot back. It was Marshall who was subverting the talks, to give the U.S. a free hand to do as it pleased in its zone of Germany. Bideau interjected. It was better, he said, after 17 sessions in which they had accomplished practically nothing, to adjourn than to further aggravate relations. And so they did, with no mention of future meetings. The age of Yalta has come to an end, declared the New York Herald Tribune. Clay saw in that moment the ominous beginnings of a competitive struggle, not with arms, but with economic resources, with ideas, and with ideals. Over the next 3 days, Clay and Robertson mapped out plans to transform the Frankfurt-based Bizonal Economic Council, comprised of West German representatives, into a true provisional government. Clay's enthusiasm showed a stunning change in mindset. In the spring, he had blasted moves to split the country. Though Clay had earlier argued that compromise with Russia would spread democracy and U.S. influence to eastern Germany, he now argued for a unilateral posture to keep communism out of the West. We cannot and we must not take the risk of losing western Germany and having all of Germany become a satellite of the USSR. As powerful as we are, it would be almost impossible for us to resist communism in the face of a Russo-German agreement. The United States was engaged in political warfare and had to attack communism and the police state before the German people. Clay's conversion from dove to hawk had been inevitable in Boland's view, only belated. Back in June 1945, Clay had told Boland that Stimson had it right. To gain Soviet trust, the United States would have to show trust. Boland responded that, within a year, Clay would become one of the officials in the American government most opposed to the Soviets. He was off by a year. Clay's actions in suspending reparations and initiating bizonal fusion had stoked Soviet hostility, which in turn pushed him to end his campaign of opposition against Marshall's go-it-alone strategy. Our work in London has brought us into a very close relationship with State Department personnel concerned with occupation policy, he reported to Army Undersecretary William Draper on December 20, 1947, and there appears to be little real difference in our thinking as to the future. Marshall, however, seems to have felt otherwise. With no warning to Clay or the War Department, he would announce a few weeks later, on January 8, 1948, that the State Department would assume full control of the German occupation from July 1st, a move that had been urged by Lovett and Kennan. Marshall's intention was to replace Kay with Bedell Smith, one of the Secretary of State's few close friends. General Smith, for his part, was anxious to leave Moscow and gain his fourth star by moving to Berlin as military governor. Clay was surprised to learn of the impending switch from Smith himself, but professed to be happy to return home. When an angry Burns learned of the move, however, he successfully maneuvered, without Clay's knowledge, to line up Senate committee leaders and block confirmation. I don't think General Marshall or General Smith recognized that the appointment as military governor required Senate confirmation, Clay reflected years later. He would, over the year after he was supposed to have returned home, face his greatest challenge yet in Berlin. Murphy had anticipated this challenge back in October. He had warned that any move to refashion the Bizonal Economic Council into a West German government would transform Berlin, 120 miles to the east of the Bizone border, into an island in the heart of the Soviet zone, in which the Russians could easily make our lives unbearable. Following the collapse of the London CFM, the CIA warned of the possibility of steps being taken in Berlin by the Soviet authorities to force the other occupying powers to remove from Berlin. Clay acknowledged there might be difficulties in the city, but thought he could manage them. This would prove short-sighted. Marshall was now convinced that, unless Western Germany is effectively associated with Western Europe nations, First through economic arrangements and ultimately, perhaps in some political way, there is a real danger that the whole of Germany will be drawn into the Eastern orbit. Bevin, too, was sure of the need for action to prevent the emergence of a communist-controlled Germany. The two endorsed the Clay Robertson plans on December 18th. The 72-year-old U.S. Chief of Staff to the Commander-in-Chief, Admiral William Leahy, backed the step, but not without deep reservations over where he was sure it would lead. The Soviets, he noted in his diary, would offer violent objection. They would use military power, if necessary, to protect their interests. The United States, therefore, needed to begin a partial mobilization of forces of defense without any delay. It was becoming clear that the Marshall Plan and mobilization were not alternatives. To the contrary, Washington might need the second to ensure the success of the first. The next day, December 19th, the Kremlin-backed Tägliche Rundschau, Berlin Daily, insisted that quadripartite control in the city could only be justified as long as the country as a whole remained under four-power rule. 3 weeks later, it declared that the Anglo-American initiative to create a West German state nullified Western rights in Berlin. Within Western Germany itself, there was growing realization that self-government in the Western zones was the best it could be hoped for at this stage. "None of our people will say so openly," said a German official to the New York Times, "but they realize that the only hope for rehabilitation is an unhampered program for Western Germany with United States aid. Eastern Germany must be written off, and all we can do is feel sorry for the Germans caught behind the Russian orientation line." The State Department had no doubt that German public opinion would be important to the success of their efforts to revive Western Europe's war-shattered economy. Germans would obviously welcome aid, but their cooperation could not be taken for granted. Most still did not want their country split and knew that a hostile Russian reaction to the Marshall Plan made such a split more likely. Since the Allies controlled the flow of news within Western Germany, the conditions were not present for a free and informed public debate. Nonetheless, Western Germans were broadly aware of the American initiative and the Soviet reaction to it. On July 22, 1947, 3 weeks after Molotov's walkout in Paris, the newly formed Economic Council, Wirtschaftsrat, of the Bi-Zone had issued a public statement praising the Marshall Plan as an effort to achieve the solidarity of the peoples in economic life. Konrad Adenauer, Christian Democratic Union, CDU, chairman in the British occupation zone, welcomed the plan as Germany's only chance to improve its standing and influence. He would, over the next months, also come to see it as the touchstone for judging the wisdom of the entirety of the Allies' occupation strategy. The left-leaning Social Democrats, SPD, had a much more spirited debate over the initiative. British Zone SPD Chairman Kurt Schumacher had to implore party delegates to ditch slogans condemning dollar imperialism and instead focus on the 100 million Europeans who were going hungry. Marshall, he reminded them, had pledged not to remake Europe solely through the orthodox and missionary methods peculiar to American capitalism. Schumacher was attracted by what he saw as elements of a planned economy in the initiative. It was, he argued, economic crisis that brought Hitler to power, and the United States was now indispensable in preventing another one. Schumacher was a passionate advocate of German unification, who, unlike Adenauer, would have accepted German political neutrality as its price. This stance should have tilted him toward Moscow. Yet he initially clung to the hope that the Marshall Plan might provide an impetus to unification. A resolution of the Party Congress offered that the irresistible magnetism of a revitalized Bi-Zone economy would serve to bring this about. Moscow's post-Paris condemnation of the plan rendered this argument implausible, but also served to reinforce Schumacher's support for it on the grounds that the Soviets were now working against German interests. Only the Wirtschaftsrat's communist representatives opposed the Marshall Plan on the basis that it would impede reunification. Communist rejection of the Marshall Plan, however, found little support among the West German public. An October 1947 poll in the American zone reported 78% in favor of the plan with most believing that Washington's primary motivation was preventing communists from coming to power in Western Europe. Underpinning popular support for the Marshall Plan was the belief that it represented a renunciation of the Morgenthau Plan. Including Germany in the task of European rehabilitation, Stuttgart's Wirtschaftszeitung wrote, means conceding to it the means for the full use of its economic strengths. It meant that the United States would allow no return to the economic and political autarky of the interwar years, which many held to be the source of the country's problems since the 1930s. Ulbricht, however, remained confident Germans would put unity before all else. It is imperative to keep in mind, he wrote to Soviet Central Committee agitprop chief Mikhail Suslov on December 12, that it was not yet evident to everyone that a defensive German unity also means a battle against bizonal politics and against the Marshall Plan. This is only becoming apparent to many now in connection with the debates at the London Conference. Across the Atlantic, Walter Lippmann opposed the new American thinking on West German statehood. The idea has been abandoned by all responsible men, that Western Germany should be formed as a state, and that we should make a separate peace with it. It would make deeper and more permanent the division between East and West, with enormous economic and political costs. An opponent of Kennan's containment ideas, he equally opposed linking the Marshall Plan to any sort of West European military alliance. It would only confirm the most serious charge which the communists make against the Marshall Plan. Yet he was also convinced that the development of massive U.S. air power supremacy over the Soviet Union was essential to the success of the plan. Since Mr. Molotov intends to keep the Red Army in the center of Europe, he wrote, we have no choice but to build up and maintain an operational striking force capable of delivering a sustained assault at long range. James Rushton also declared U.S. policy weak in that it is not combined with a clear commitment by the United States to use its power against any future aggressor in Europe. The view was taking hold that the Marshall Plan was a necessary but not sufficient response to the stalemate over Germany. A free and self-sustaining Western Europe would have to be defended by a credible American military posture. We had better stop kidding ourselves, one official told Rushton anonymously. While we talk about recovery in Washington and London, the communists are wrecking our recovery plans in France and Italy. We cannot deal with this problem through economic aid alone. The Marshall Plan needed a Marshall Plan. The Wall Street Journal took a different line. It was critical of the economic assumptions behind the Marshall Plan, and more broadly of the wisdom of the planners in Washington. Yet it also believed, as did many of the plan's prominent supporters, that the administration's traditional refrain, that the plan was a much less costly alternative to war, was ridiculous. There is a close relationship between the Marshall Program and a big military budget, but it has never been a choice between the one and the other. On the contrary, the more actively we intervene in European affairs, the more we jostle that political powder keg, the more it behooves us to look to our own defenses. The Marshall Plan is no more an alternative to rearmament than was the Lend-Lease program before the last war, although the avowed purpose of Lend-Lease was to keep us out of the fighting. Given the reality of the communist threat from without and within, there was little chance that Marshall Plan countries would follow through on making themselves economically interdependent, and thereby undermining their self-sufficiency, unless, in Rushton's words, they have assurance that they will not be abandoned in the event of aggression. As to Marshall's determination to move ahead with West German industrial revival and statehood, France never will cooperate unless she has the backing of United States power. For his part, Stalin did not want or anticipate war at this point, but he had begun preparing for it. Since 1945, the Soviet armed forces had been slashed from 11 million to under 4 million, and military spending from 54% of the budget to 18%. In November 1947, however, the Politburo ordered a quadrupling of tank production and a tripling of artillery production for 1948. Troop increases would follow a year later, beginning with parachute and transport divisions. The United States was conducting a Cold War of nerves with the aim of blackmail, Stalin's deputy, Georgi Malenkov told Italian socialist Pietro Nenni. But the Soviet Union will not allow itself to be intimidated. Marshall, who refused to use the term Marshall Plan, went before Congress to defend it for the first time on November 10, 1947, at a joint meeting of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations and the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Feeling the strain of the campaign, he was putting the odds of a bill's passage at no better than 50-50. The result was a much starker East versus West framing than he had offered previously. Marshall's testimony is striking for the brusqueness with which he passes from asserting the tremendous gravity of Europe's economic problems, on which he had previously tended to linger, to laying down the Cold War basis for an aid plan. Which countries were in and which were out would, he said, be determined roughly by the line upon which the Anglo-American armies coming from the West met those of the Soviet Union coming from the East. These were shades of Churchill's Iron Curtain speech the year prior. No longer was there any pretense that borders created by war were temporary, that the positioning of forces should no longer matter, that Europe could be reconstructed on principles divorced from power. To the west of that line, the nations of the continental European community have been grappling with a vast and difficult problem resulting from the war with their own national traditions, without pressure or menace from the United States, he said. But developments to the east of that line bear the unmistakable imprint of an alien hand. Marshall, who had recoiled at anti-communist rhetoric in Truman's Doctrine speech, and carefully avoided it in his own at Harvard, was now dialing it up to win over Congress. Marshall would years later claim that he did not want to fight for the plan on this basis. But Vandenberg stated we would have to fight this out on an anti-communist line, and the senator was our principal advisor on the basis of U.S. political problems. Truman took the torch on November 17th, delivering his first special message to Congress on the Marshall Plan. The future of the free nations of Europe hangs in the balance, he said, and the manner in which we exert our strength will have a decisive effect upon the course of civilization. His much longer address of December 19th painted the consequences of failure to act in stark political terms. He warned of the need to defend freedom and the rule of law in Europe against those who would use economic distress as a pretext for the establishment of a totalitarian state. If such forces were to gain the upper hand, it might well compel us to modify our own economic system and to forego, for the sake of our own security, the enjoyment of many of our freedoms and privileges. This is why the United States had so vital an interest in strengthening the belief of the people of Europe that freedom from fear and want will be achieved under free and democratic governments. It would not be easy, however. We must not be blind to the fact that the communists have announced determined opposition to any effort to help Europe get back on its feet. He left unspecified which communists these were, but warned none too subtly that attempts by any nation to prevent or sabotage European recovery for selfish ends are clearly contrary to the purposes of the Charter of the New United Nations. This served to rebut charges that the United States was acting outside the UN, while asserting that Soviet behavior was undermining it. Following the President's dramatic March 1947 address, many Republicans had felt they had been maneuvered into supporting Greek and Turkish aid by the suggestion that rejecting it meant being soft on Soviet aggression. They were determined not to let the White House corner them again. Vandenberg at the time called for a moratorium on further aid appropriations in that session of Congress. By November, however, the tone in Washington had changed. Vandenberg and Marshall were meeting at Blair House, the White House guest residence, twice a week on average, with the media unaware of their coordination. With a year to go until a critical presidential election, even the leading Republican contender, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, issued a powerful statement of endorsement. If, as Bismarck says, history occurs when things happen, the Washington Post observed, the last 5 months have teemed with history. There had, Reston observed, been an astonishing development of American public opinion toward the idea of a broad-scale European aid program. The future historian, Reston said, was likely to be more impressed by the advances that have been made this summer in getting the nations of the West together on a common task than by anything else. Yet Republican congressmen still demanded to see the situation for themselves, and their visits to Europe did much to blunt the line that the White House was exaggerating the need for American assistance. The House of Representatives, Reston observed, was now not just divided into parties, but into those who went away and those who stayed home. In November, the administration named the Marshall Plan the European Recovery Program, ERP, with the word recovery intended to highlight the difference with other aid initiatives since the war's end. The numerous congressional hearings over the ERP that took place between the fall of 1947 and the spring of 1948 brought out the sweeping breadth of the administration's aims, all of which had taken form in a matter of months after Britain's imperial collapse back in February. Embracing 19th-century language that FDR had been determined to banish from diplomatic parlance, Forrestal highlighted the imbalance between the world's two great powers, one that the United States needed to redress by rebuilding Western Europe. Ambassador Douglas said that the Europeans needed to create the type of economic federal union that we now have in the United States, harking back to the replacement of the American Articles of Confederation with the Constitution in 1787. Marshall called European integration one of the most important considerations in the entire program. John Foster Dulles said it would create a counterbalance to the Soviet system of police states. West Germany would become part of a solid front whose defenses could not be easily reduced even by Soviet power. Failure to integrate, however, would perpetuate conditions that might lead more desperate European governments to accept a Soviet-dictated peace. But Soviet domination in Europe would not be the end of the story. The supplanting of democratic governments by totalitarian ones tied to Moscow, Douglas argued, would lead to state control of strategic economic assets that would imperil the economic security of the United States. This would, in turn, lead to demands at home for more government control over the American economy, which was incompatible with the liberty its citizens had enjoyed since the nation's founding. America's political isolation would, Harriman believed, necessarily lead to soaring defense expenditures and a militarization of society. The threat extended even to our very form of government. Hoffman argued that Americans could not expect to isolate our free economy and have it work. A proliferation of government monopolies in Europe, said General Electric Chairman Philip D. Reed, would require parallel developments in the United States, and that would destroy our free enterprise system. Broadly, then, the administration's case was that it was necessary to reorganize the economies of Western Europe in America's image to prevent its subjugation by Moscow, a development that would undermine the economy, security, and political system of the United States. The narrative did not go unchallenged. Henry Wallace led the attack from the left. Far from reviving the European economy, he said, the ERP would undermine the most positive elements of it, such as nationalization of industry, social welfare expansion, and government controls on trade. The State Department, which he believed to have been captured by monopoly private interests, was determined merely to perpetuate Europe's semi-colonial dependence on the United States. His program would cleave the continent into rival blocks, slow recovery by severing traditional East-West trade links, and fan international tensions, possibly leading to World War III. In the United States, Wallace said, the ERP would boost the profits of agricultural, oil, steel, and shipping trusts at the expense of American workers and farmers and independent businessmen, who would have to contend with the resulting shortages, inflation, union busting, and social service cuts. In its place, Wallace advocated creation of a $50 billion fund, three times as large as the administration was calling for, run by the United Nations, which would finance a European New Deal. The primary beneficiaries would be the victims of Nazi aggression, including the Soviet Union and the East European states. The UN would reverse the Germany First orientation of the administration's plan. Ohio Republican Senator and presidential candidate Robert Taft, who had been the most formidable congressional opponent of Bretton Woods 3 years earlier, led the attack on the ERP from the right. But his objections were less sweeping than Wallace's. Taft backed the vision of an integrated Western Europe embracing Western Germany, believing that such integration was necessary to keep the United States out of entangling commitments to prop it up. Taft also supported the principle of American economic aid to Western Europe, which his ally Herbert Hoover said was necessary to create a dam against Russian aggression. Taft believed the administration's request, $17 billion, $184 billion in today's money, over 4 years, to be much too large, however. Aid at such a level would, he believed, create a dangerous dependency on the United States, sapping both private sector and governmental incentives to manage Europe's own resources properly. Democrats tried to undermine Taft by arguing that he was only aiding the Soviets and their supporters. "Those who oppose the Marshall Plan, I think," said Illinois Senator Scott Lucas before an 800-delegate Women's Patriotic Conference on National Defense, "should suffer some slight embarrassment in finding themselves in agreement with the Communist Party." But this argument failed to sway Taft's fellow Ohioan, Republican Representative Frederick Smith, who considered the plan itself outright communism. Free market commentator Henry Hazlitt testified similarly, advocating an aid package roughly half the size of the administration's request, but conditioned on major changes in recipient country policies. Hazlitt wanted to roll back the tide of nationalization, trade controls, and social welfare expansion that, he argued, would further constrain output, worsen inflation, and increase Europe's dollar shortage. "Let these currencies trade freely at more appropriate exchange rates, or return to the classical gold standard, in which interest rates moved to balance imports and exports, and the shortage would disappear." Instead, France was making it worse by forcing exporters to swap 90% of their dollar proceeds for francs at an unattractive rate, discouraging production for export. The Marshall Plan, as formulated, Hazlitt believed, was only going to further the assault on private enterprise that was the primary source of Europe's economic woes. Like Wallace and the left, Hazlitt and the right also believed that the Marshall Plan would redound to the detriment of the U.S. economy, which would reel under the shortages and inflation it would trigger. Their remedies for such maladies, however, could not have been more different. In essence, Wallace saw laissez-faire as the Marshall Plan's malevolent lodestar. Hazlitt, cursing the same navigational law, saw socialism. With the vote approaching on interim aid to France, $328 million, Italy, $227 million, and Austria, $42 million, Taft launched a new series of attacks, thumping Marshall aid as inflationary, fiscally reckless, and conceptually misguided. "The administration," he said, "can't get away from the New Deal principle that government spending is a good thing in itself." Fellow Republicans demanded answers. "What do we get for our aid? Won't meddling in Europe's affairs feed the Russian narrative? Isn't China more important? And most importantly, what if France and Italy go communist anyway?" If they fell under communist control, Lovett told them, he would advise the president to cut off funds. But he hated having to say so publicly. The communists, he told Marshall, would brandish his words for propaganda purposes. Yet it was, he was sure, necessary to stop this line of questioning before it wrecked the prospects for aid. 8. Sausage. "Laws," observed 19th century poet John Godfrey Saxe, "like sausages, cease to inspire respect in proportion as we know how they are made." As 1947 drew to a close, legislating Marshall aid looked to be a case in point. With less than a year to go before he would have to face the voters, the president's political advisers were hard at work trying to leverage Europe's crisis to his benefit. There was, White House counsel Clark Clifford said, political advantage in Truman's tough approach to Russia. He was largely invulnerable to attack from the right, not least because of his brilliant appointment of General Marshall, who was seen as nonpartisan and above politics. But Republicans will insist that everything that is good about American foreign policy is Marshall, and everything that is bad is Truman. And if the American people identify Secretary Marshall and not the president as our spokesman, it is bad politics for 1948.
Truman needed to seize control of the narrative. The real challenge to the president, however, might not come from the right, but from the left, a third party run by Henry Wallace that could tip the election to Dewey. The president needed to get prominent liberals and progressives on board by pointing out that the core of the Wallace backing is made up of communists and fellow travelers. At the same time, Clifford assistant George Elsie said, "The non-military side of the Truman Doctrine should be accented." This is where the European Recovery Program came in. Truman, a veteran of rough political battles, was not averse, in Lippmann's words, to throwing a partisan monkey wrench into the ERP campaign. At Clifford's advice, he picked a fight with the Republicans by linking the ERP to domestic policy, hoping to tar them for rising prices. On November 17, 1947, Truman devoted three-quarters of his special message to the Congress on the ERP to economic challenges on the home front. Meeting the country's global obligations, Truman argued, meant getting its own house in order. Treasury Secretary John Snyder had demanded that the ERP be fully funded. The administration would insist on balanced budgets in every year of the program, but discipline also needed to be applied on prices, which rose 14.4% in 1947. High inflation owed partially to overvalued European commodities, which were fueling demand for American goods. Truman did not make this point. Yet in his longer address on the ERP a month later, on December 19th, he would argue that price increases in the United States were exacerbating Europe's plight by raising the cost of vital imports. The president called for sweeping measures to roll back inflation, including price controls, wage ceilings, rationing, export restrictions, credit restriction, and a commodity speculation crackdown. These he had, only a few weeks earlier, referred to as police state methods. But Clifford had convinced him to propose something absolutely unpalatable to the Republican majority, so as to pass the fault for high prices on to them. Today, a foreign dollar shortage and domestic inflation would be considered matters for monetary policy, central banks abroad allowing the exchange value of their currencies to adjust downward, and the Federal Reserve pushing interest rates upward at home. They would not be subjects of presidential speeches calling for dramatic fiscal and regulatory intervention. Inappropriate monetary policies in both the United States and Europe were, in fact, making the problems necessitating European aid, as well as the problems of financing it, worse. Truman would, in his December speech, defend the Marshall Plan as a means of reducing Europe's trade deficits with the United States, particularly by increasing European exports. That the administration was, at this point, still wedded to exchange rate stabilization, however, suggested that the monetary dimensions of the plan suffered from an unwillingness to confront domestic interests anxious to sustain a competitive, that is, undervalued dollar. Snyder would, in February 1948, call for some unnamed countries among the Marshall Aid participants to devalue, subject to IMF approval, but he rejected calls from Congress to convene a special international monetary conference for the purpose of coordinating such devaluation. The administration had no appetite for a new Bretton Woods. Lippmann chided Truman for tossing rationing and price controls into his November address, accusing him of using an international crisis to bait the Republicans into taking responsibility for the high cost of living. Instead, he said, powers need to be given to the Federal Reserve System to check the creation of excess bank credit, as Federal Chairman Mariner Eccles wanted. This was the only effective way to restrain inflation, as well as the only responsible way politically. It would allow Congress to deal with the Marshall Plan, wisely and dispassionately, rather than as part of a political package designed to help the administration shed blame for the economy. Truman's tactics infuriated Vandenberg, but, as Clifford had anticipated, most of the senator's colleagues recoiled before his dire warnings not to allow communist wrecking crews to destroy Europe's recovery. The Senate interim aid bill breezed through by a vote of 83-6 on December 1, 1947. The House version passed by voice vote on the 11th. In the resolution process to meld the two bills, a provision was added permitting aid to China.
and House language directing the president to cut off aid if a country came to be dominated by the Communist Party or the Soviet Union was made more general and less prescriptive. On December 15th, the final bill, authorizing $522 million, $5.65 billion in today's money, in assistance for France, Italy, and Austria, $75 million less than the administration had requested, passed by voice vote in the Senate, and 313-82 in the House. Of the 82 voting against, 70 were Republican. Nearly half the no votes, 40, were from just five states, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, and Truman's home state of Missouri. The administration still had work to do convincing the heartland of the wisdom of the much larger Marshall Aid package. On December 19th, the president submitted his ERP legislation to Congress, urging ratification by April 1, 1948, when the stopgap funding would be exhausted. Simultaneous with the aid votes, Truman got what he wanted on domestic policy, trivial legislation side by side with the interim aid vote, authorizing only three of his 10 anti-inflation measures, export controls, transportation controls, and conservation encouragement. These victories allowed him to pose as a hawk on inflation, an issue he cared little about, while painting the GOP Congress as do-nothings. But it came at a cost. Angry Republicans would press hard in the new year for their own domestic agenda, particularly large tax cuts, which would compete with the ERP for scarce resources. Time named George Marshall its 1947 Man of the Year. But the magazine still expected the congressional debate over his namesake plan to be long, serious, and at times vitriolic. For his part, Vandenberg took little comfort from the victory on interim aid, given the sums involved in the main bill to come. Marshall is certainly going to have a hell of a time down here on the Hill when he gets around to his long-range plan, the senator wrote to his wife. And to Lovett, we're headed for the storm cellar on the Marshall plan. Even if some bill might eventually satisfy Republicans, it could, Vandenberg knew, be for a much smaller and very different plan than the one Marshall was proposing. With this risk in mind, Vandenberg had begun to look for sweeteners back in the fall, things that Europe might provide to the United States in return for aid. There was precedent for such requests. Congress had demanded consideration from Britain in return for lend-lease aid in 1941, in spite of Roosevelt insisting that such aid was itself in the American national interest. Vandenberg now pressed the administration to insist on consideration from Europe and its colonies as a requirement for participating in the Marshall Program. This would include preferential U.S. access to strategic rare materials such as cobalt for aircraft engines and uranium for atomic energy. The Harriman Committee estimated that $253 million, $2.74 billion in today's money worth of strategic materials, could be made available to the United States each year from the 16 nations and their dependencies. The State Department pledged to work for such promises from Europe. Other congressmen sought military cooperation and assistance. We ought to start getting something for our money, insisted Wisconsin Republican Senator Alexander Wiley. I want to know if any effort has been made to obtain strategic bases or materials in return for our generosity. This cut was embarrassingly close to Stalin's charge that establishing such bases was, in fact, the purpose of the Marshall Plan. It was also a repudiation of Roosevelt's statement at Yalta that U.S. troops would not remain in Europe for more than 2 years after the war. But on Capitol Hill, injecting the principle of consideration into the proposal did much, as it had with Lend-Lease, to blunt the charge that the United States was just giving away its resources with no certain payoff. And so despite the passion with which the right and the left had bludgeoned the administration's proposal in the fall, the pendulum had, by January 1948, swung in the direction of passage. Few voices of consequence were still suggesting that there should not be a recovery program of some sort, or that the United States could afford to ignore Europe's plight at little or no cost to itself. As James Rustin summarized the transformation, the United States had moved away from isolationism and moved farther and faster toward world responsibility than any other country in history. The only question was whether it had moved far enough and fast enough to stay up with events. Helping the administration's effort was growing support from the leadership of business interest groups, who often, in defiance of their more protectionist rank and file, backed the agenda of expanding trade by shrinking the dollar gap. Acceptance of the need for the United States to import more from Europe represented a sea change in outlook, unimaginable after the First World War.